Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my colleague in all things strategy, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Chair of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, how are you doing on this eve of a holiday?
We're doing very well. You may actually hear the noise of some rambunctious grandchildren upstairs. I'm hiding in the basement for the moment, away from the din. But it's, given everything that's going on in the world, it's a particularly significant, I think, holiday of freedom. And I think directly relevant in that sense to our guest today. So why don't you introduce him and let the conversation begin?
Well, in not only tied to a holiday of freedom, but to the vote over the weekend for Ukraine aid. Our guest today is Ilya Ponomarenko, a journalist, formerly of the Kyiv Independent. Now you can read his journalism on Twitter, and you can support him on Buy Me a Coffee. And he's the author of I Will Show You How It Was, the story of wartime Kyiv, just published by Bloomsbury. Ilya, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And by the way, I don't have that book yet. Well, many people do send me pictures from, you know, of that book in their hands in print, but I don't have it yet. So
the cover is very effective. They did a good job by you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good.
So your journalism, for many of us who were trying to follow events in Ukraine early in the war in particular, was absolutely essential. Both your articles in the Kyiv Independent, your Twitter feed. So thank you for that, and congratulations on the book. What decided you on moving away from daily journalism and writing the book?
The book is about the Battle of Kyiv in 2022, which I consider, and I'm pretty sure about this, is the opening act of the full-scale Russian invasion, and also the most important and one of the most important events of modern history that defined the entire duration of Russian invasion up to this day. So it's pivotal. It's something that determined where we are now. And the Ukrainian victory, early victory, just essentially derailed this war from Russian side. So this really touched upon me, because I was witnessing all this as a journalist and also the guy living in Kyiv. So at some point, we at the Kyiv Post, Kyiv Independent, we decided to write a book about something, about the war. We decided, this was a new startup. So we decided that we need some fresh step in this regard. And we decided to write a book. When it comes to timing, I started doing it around Christmas time 2022 and the first months of 2023, which was still an extremely hard time for Ukraine, because there was a battle of Bakhmut, for instance. A lot of things, it's super intense, this whole war is super intense. So actually, when it comes to dividing time for journalism and for writing, I didn't have to. So I had to go on working, covering things, writing articles. I even went to the Battle of Bakhmut, one of the biggest battles of modern time. And I had to go on writing the book as well. So it was both for me, you know, usual work, everyday work, and it was dedication, service, and also writing the books. And also the understanding that I had to complete it as soon as possible. It should be as good as possible for this. So I decided to have a book about the Battle of Kyiv because I had so much to tell. And I was understanding that it's going to be called by historians of the future one of the pivotal moments of modern history, at least here in Europe.
If I could just say, I mean, it is one of the things that's very powerful about it. It is a love note to Kyiv, particularly in the first part of the book where you describe what life is like in the city. And it's a, you know, as I think I've said earlier on the podcast, even in wartime, it is a lovely and charming city. And I think it also brings home what it must have been like to be a reporter covering a war literally in your backyard that sort of suddenly shows up in the suburbs. I was wondering, could you just elaborate a little bit about why you think this was such a decisive battle? I mean, obviously, had the Russians been able to take Kyiv, the whole war would have looked very different. Who knows what it would have done with the Ukrainian government. But perhaps could you explain that a little bit further? Because there is a sense throughout the book that this is kind of a momentous watershed in ways that maybe some audiences in the West may not have fully appreciated.
It was, and I do consider this pivotal because of the chances that Ukrainian military had in this battle, and because of the significance and the importance that the Russians themselves put on this in this battle. You know, this special military operation, as they call it, it was supposed to be completed within 10-15 days, with Kyiv taken within first 3 days. That's not what we think of. This is what they have in their documents. You know, by day 10th, they were supposed to be encircling Kyiv by the city of Kaniv, which is way south into central Ukraine. From this, you know, from the moment of now, it feels absolutely unrealistic. But from the very beginning, they were just going all 9 yards into Kyiv, into, you know, fast operation to have a landing at the Hostomel airfield and to ensure even bigger invasion force, and then to do it really fast and quick to paralyze the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian government system, to immediately instigate the societal collapse and to get the city paralyzed and absolutely beheaded. So within days, so they put everything upon this fast operation, like Shukinave thing, including in terms of not only, you know, dropping airborne troopers outside of Kyiv so they could, you know, lay the path towards even bigger forces, but also in terms of, you know, the main forces, the ones who are crossing the Belarusian border and entering Kyiv area from the north, because they were lightly armed. They were supposed to go fast to reach out to Kyiv and to enter Kyiv really fast. So the speed was the biggest thing. So they put everything on taking Kyiv. Kyiv was the main thing. So in many ways, this surprising failure was essentially the end of the entire idea. It's like when we have a Schlieffen blitzkrieg failing on day second because railway communications just cannot put enough forces into this. And this was like one of the pivotal moments for the entire plan. So this derailed, and especially when it comes to, you know, chances of Ukraine, we're talking about Ukrainian chances in the Battle of Kyiv. You know, we know now that the Ukrainian military, like this was proportion between the Ukrainian military and the Russian forces in the Kyiv area, it's like 1-10, close to 1-10. So as you understand, that doesn't look like a very good chance. But the Ukrainian military managed to use their advantage. The Ukrainian military managed to use the Russian mistakes and Russian misconceptions about the Ukrainian ability to fight and their readiness to avoid the first strike, you know, the first missile barrage, which was successfully avoided in many ways in terms of munitions, bases, airfields, and also like that. And despite, you know, you remember the sentiments that were reigning around the world back in those days, like half of the world was just burying Ukraine alive because there was perception of Russia as undeniable, undefeatable force that will do as it please. And in the end, we end up having a victory because of a lot of dedication demonstrated by so many people, not only in the military, but also lots of civilians who decided to stay and to fight, you know, doing the right thing and making, after all, making moral choice. So when it comes to, you know, writing this book and choosing the topic, I initially wanted to write a book about, you know, military history, lots of maps, arrows, you know, fancy military terms. But in the end, I decided that I have something else to tell about those days, which is this moral choice and the choice of so many regular people like you and me doing what they had to do and, you know, believing what is right on those days. And, you know, from the distance of time, today we understand that, yeah, Russians had a failing plan. It was an absolutely unrealistic plan. But in those moments, we were clearly understanding that this might be the end of us. This might be the end of this country and to many of us personally. So, but nonetheless, so many people are doing their job.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up, if I could, on some of what you said towards the end there about the lack of realism of the Russian plan, because one of the things you described particularly well is the drumbeat and buildup of rhetoric and propaganda by Russia before the actual invasion in February of 2022. And you talk about it as, you know, being totally disconnected from any kind of reality. And I'm curious about two things. One, what are the things in particular that you think they got wrong about Ukraine? Because clearly their plan, as you say, was based on a series of assumptions about what they would find when they came into Ukraine. So the difference between what they assumed and the reality they encountered, from your point of view, I'd love to hear you talk about. The other is you compare a lot of their rhetoric to Russian, using Russian criminal slang as an extortion, you know, effort of Russia against Ukraine and Ukrainians sort of feeling that they were being extorted by Russia. And I'd love to hear you discuss that as well. I mean, how widespread a view is that among Ukrainians? Is that pretty universal now? There was a period of time when people thought Russian-speaking Ukrainians, Russophones, might be more open to propaganda from Russia. There were a certain number of collaborators we know, particularly in the south. But overall, as you describe, Ukrainians have been incredibly stalwart. So I'd love to hear you talk about any or all of that.
You know, the Russian perception of Ukrainians were so wrong because, you know, there's a moment in human history that I look more and more and I find it more and more throughout, you know, human history, is that, you know, dictatorships and dictatorial regimes, they by themselves, by default, bear the seed of their own fall. Starting from the beginning, it's the part of their nature to bear the seed of their eventual fall, which is the absurdity in many ways and them being a hostage to their own delusions and their own propaganda and their own misconceptions that they need to survive and to, you know, formalize themselves as the power, but also disconnect them from reality and make them do unreasonable steps, irrational steps that are harmful to them, but part of their nature. You know, as an example, you know, one could recall the fact that, for instance, in Nazi Germany, but towards the end of World War II, you know, Nazis were using railway transportation to put even more people into death camps, to kill even more people in there, instead of, you know, using transportation, you know, vital, absolutely important transportation for actual war. But nonetheless, they were wasting their resources to kill people, to kill Jews, because of their doctrines, because of their rhetorics, because of the very nature of how they work. Something similar, you know, by nature, also touches upon the Russian dictatorship, because they built, you know, Vladimir Putin's regime and his clique, they built their rule over Russia on hatred, on denying Ukrainians as a nation, on considering their superior ones, putting themselves first, on this Russian supremacy by default, on this negligent attitude towards Ukrainians and towards many other nations that used to be their colonies. That it's such an integral part of Russian mindset, imperial mindset, you know, of the Russian way to hold and impose power, that they eventually became the absurd hostages of these things, of the propaganda, of their rhetorics. So in many ways, yeah, they simply denied understanding, denied themselves of understanding and thinking about Ukrainians as people who love their country, who have their own traditions, who have their own, you know, appreciation towards what we have. We are very different from Russians in terms of our culture, you know, our mindsets, our economy, our everything. You know, we are, you know, especially when it comes to the time as of now, we are so culturally disconnected. You know, we exist in our own universe in here. We have our own internet memes. We have our own, you know, song contests, singers, and, you know, cultural things, and, you know, films. We are a country in its own. It's very common for any countries that are out there in the world. And most importantly, yeah, they bitterly underestimated this, Ukrainians being a nation, and being a nation that loves themselves and appreciates, not being an ideal nation, of course, but still, you know, Ukrainians wanting to be on their own as a nation. So they definitely underappreciated this because of their arrogance in many ways, and their emphasis on this, you know, Russian supremacy over, you know, over little brothers such as Belarusians, Russians, you name it. And when it comes to their rhetoric for decades, you know, they also built their rhetoric upon this, you know, thug language, especially, you know, when it comes to, you know, public policy, diplomacy, which is stunning in human history. It's absolutely almost unprecedented. You know, it belongs to the worst dictatorships in human history. You know, when we sometimes compare the present time Russian regime with Soviets, but, you know, Soviets were never like that. They have sophisticated diplomats. Yeah, they were involved in the Cold War, but Soviets never had this absurdly outrageous propaganda that touches upon the lowest lows of the human nature, the darkest bits of the human nature, the worst things about, you know, about hatred, about the, you know, the drive for violence, you know, the arrogance. They emphasized, they built their rule upon this, upon using the worst features of human nature. And one of the things that we keep talking about in media and beyond, as we are being asked about this, is that many Western leaders, they still perceive Vladimir Putin, his regime, his officials, as also government, you know, officials, as, you know, public figures. But in reality, there, you know, there is a book about the Russian regime. It's called Mafia State, because they are not governmental officials or historical leaders. They are mafia in all features of it. They are mafia. They came to power as mafia. They rule Russia as mafia. They, you know, divvy up resources of Russia among themselves as mafia. So they exterminate and assassinate the mafia. So it's a mafia. We're not talking about, you know, government managers or something like that, or politicians with political careers and all those things that we normally see in, you know, Western leaders, for instance. It's a mafia. So they do as a mafia because they are mafia. They're criminals. It's a criminal regime that happens to possess entire nuclear power with all of its resources.
Do you know, one thing that you talk about a bit in the book is, or that you allude to, which is something people often talk about in the West, and that is that in a certain sense, the Russians lost the war at the Battle of Kyiv. And I think what people usually mean by that is not just that they weren't able to complete their original idea, which does look preposterous in retrospect of taking the whole country, a country bigger than France, in 10 days, with what looks like, in retrospect, a force that's way too small for that, but in a much deeper sense, that they lost the war, that the, you know, the separation between Ukraine and Russia is, you know, deep and permanent, and that even the Russian regime eventually is endangered by that. Do you agree with that, or do you feel that the Battle of Kyiv was, you know, a turning point for the initial phase of the war, but doesn't really tell us how things will eventually turn out? Where do you fall on that?
It's, you know, it's a yes and no, because I generally agree with the fact that, you know, the Russian debacle at Kyiv and their setback and their withdrawal was an unexpected turn of events that essentially derailed the entire so-called special military operation and the entire logic of this invasion. So they had to greatly narrow down their goals and switch to conquering Donbass and unleashing another nightmare of the battle in the east and in the south. To me, I would better formulate the outcome of the Battle of Kyiv as the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian nation getting a chance, winning a chance to go on and prevail in a longer fight. I would say this because, you know, in the last year or so, we grew very sore about, you know, things like saying that Putin has already lost, especially when it comes to our leadership and also the Western leaders, because throughout last year, you know, such sentiment, you know, joyful sentiment of Putin has already lost cost us a lot, because in Ukraine too, and also in the West, many people were joyful. Many decision makers were joyful. They had a sigh of relief. They decided that Putin is over. Putin has lost, and there is nothing else that should be done. You know, it's all over. So Putin simply ended up getting 2 years to get recovered and to switch to a total war without us, because we decided that it's all over. Putin is fine now, right now. Ukraine has won. So I prefer, and many in Ukrainian media community, we prefer to have a more pessimistic view about this, to be instigated by this pessimistic views. So that's why I'm formulating the Battle of Kyiv as the the victory of a historical chance to go on and avoid the early defeat and the extermination of the Ukrainian nation, and the chance to start a longer run and persuade the West step by step into providing weapons, into many other things that should have been done in there, and to, you know, winning freedom and existence in the longer run, because there was no way, of course, that Russians wanted to stop this war following the debacle of Kyiv in Istanbul, for of course. So it was a chance to get all those things that happened in the basically 2 years after. There was a chance, and it goes on.
Let me pick up on what you just mentioned about the talks in Istanbul, because your book really comes to an end with the with the success of the Battle of Kyiv and the withdrawal of Russian forces from the environs of the city, and in fact from other parts of northern Ukraine as well, even as fighting goes on in the south and in the east, as you point out. You also, towards the end of the book, talk a bit about the negotiations in Istanbul in March of 2022 and what happened. This has become actually, as I think you know, in the last week or so here in the United States, a topic of discussion because of the article that appeared in the journal Foreign Affairs or on its website by Samuel Charop of RAND and Sergei Radchenko of Johns Hopkins that walks through all of these negotiations and suggests that they failed, and they say they failed for a variety of reasons, but that the fact that negotiations took place and the documents were exchanged suggests that at some point, you know, there is scope or room for negotiation between Russia and Ukraine. What is, you know, your take on this, and what have you heard from Ukrainian officials who were involved in these discussions?
I wrote that piece about negotiations in Istanbul before the end of the Battle of Kyiv more than a year ago, and basically I briefly described what we were hearing by the end of the Battle of Kyiv, even earlier. So that was a sort of a rumors plus something hot in the news plus something that we heard from Ukrainian officials involved in there. And even back then, even before Russians announced their withdrawal from Kyiv and called us a step of goodwill, it was obvious that it's just a lot of diplomatic contact that continued throughout this battle, all started from day three or four, when it became obvious that the initial run, the initial jump and rush is kind of not going the way they want it. As you know, the initial contacts and talks started in Belarus on the day three, day four, when it became obvious that something is going clearly wrong and Ukrainians are fighting. So they have been contacts and talks all this time, but you know, knowing the even without knowing all the provisions that Russians were talking about in Istanbul, for instance, it was obvious that 99% chance is not going to work, and not because those stupid Ukrainians just do not appreciate the will of good, the will towards peace and the gesture of peace given to them by Vladimir Putin, but simply because neither Ukrainians nor Russians were ready on the negotiated settlement as an outcome of the Battle of Kyiv, because Russians were never ready for a prolonged peace, even given the debacle at Kyiv, but still they had south, they had disastrous Ukrainian situation in the east. Mariupol was being overwhelmed by then. They had the corridor between Crimea and the Russian mainland, land corridor, I'm saying. And essentially, they had absolutely all reasons to believe that, yeah, Ukrainians managed to hold on to Kyiv, but in the longer run, with a total war, given the disproportion of resources in all regards, given a pretty weak reaction in the West, and very high chances that the West will stay away, they had absolutely zero reasons to put this to an end, and I absolutely don't believe in their good faith. Sorry, that's not... this is not why they unleashed one of the biggest, if not the biggest, European war of aggression since 1945, just to give everything to Ukraine back, because they failed to capture the capital. But still, nothing prevents them from a longer war. This is what we we were talking about as we heard things like Ukrainian officials were suggesting that Ukraine might think about, you know, staying away from NATO if this is so important for Russian, you know, propaganda image, and if it's so important for Russian declaration of sort of victory because Ukraine, we prevented Ukraine from joining NATO. We were told that, okay, if you want us out of NATO, it's okay. That was the thing right from the start, even in the public. Zelensky, you know, we know it in the public that Zelensky contacted Putin about 24 hours before the invasion, saying that it's absolutely is on the table. Just do not start the war. If we can talk about NATO, we can talk about a lot of things, but you do not do this. Do not start this war. They refused. And what happened, happened. We, back then, but before the Russian withdrawal, we knew it that Ukrainians were ready to kind of formally claim Crimea as the Ukrainian territory, but hold this question off for next 15 years, which is essentially means you keep the Crimea and many other things. But in general, there was absolutely clear understanding that it's not going to work. It's not going to work because Ukrainians did not want to cease existing as a nation, and Russians, particularly, you know, the Kremlin never wanted to admit such a catastrophic failure following the unsuccessful attack on Kyiv. And in the following, you know, years and months, we learned a lot of things, like the fact that Russians demanded essentially the disarmament of the Ukrainian military, drastic cuts to Ukrainian military. They demanded that they have a say on the Western aid. They demanded that all Western weapons be absolutely removed from Ukraine, which is, you understand where this comes to. You know, they just wanted to Ukraine to be rendered defenseless and without giving absolutely anything in return.
You know, one of the things, Ilya, that you talk about in the book, I just want to pick up on that thread of Western weapons. You know, you mentioned the morale effects of knowing that the Brits were shipping Enlaw anti-tank missiles to Ukraine just before the war, just before the Russian invasion, American Javelins. And you have to think that one of the things the Russians did not expect after the fact that Ukrainian resistance would be as severe and effective as it was the degree to which the West would be willing to arm Ukraine. Now, both Eric and I are both on the record as saying we should have done more. We should be doing more. We should do it faster. We should do it on a larger scale. But still, I think when you step back, it's not what's already been done is more than I would have expected before the invasion. And I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about expectations, both about Russian expectations for what the West would do for Ukraine, but also about Ukrainian expectations at the time and now. You know, we've been through this tremendous emotional seesaw. You know, will Congress vote for that supplemental or not? We all had the very good news that belatedly, but still, you know, you got the right decision out of the House of Representatives. I think everybody's pretty confident that this week the weapons will begin flowing again to Ukraine. So could you just talk a bit about that theme, about Western support changing Russian and Ukrainian views of that?
Yeah, sure. Back then, let's call it the time of the Russian-Ukrainian war crisis, like late 2021, we were thinking about Western aid as something that's probably going to happen, but we didn't have much hope about this. I'll be frank about this. We had a lot of confidence about the United States because we always believed that we have absolute 100% rock solid bipartisan support, which ended up being a bit a bit like more complex But still, we had a lot of confidence about the United Kingdom, Baltic nations, Poland. It was true that we, right from the start, there was general sentiment about this, is that we are on our own, but still we have some friends, and our friends will send us something. Anyway, we will do, and we will fight with everything that we can have, as little as we can have, but we will fight. And besides, you know, we kind of got a lot of our own by that moment. So when it comes to my opinion about the Western aid before the invasion, I was pretty confident about the Western involvement in terms of, you know, assistance. I was pretty confident about the West not staying away completely, because I was waiting in facts that I expected the West to be extremely rational about this. I expected the West to be completely understanding the fact that an all-out war on Ukraine would produce one of the worst refugee crises that will rush towards Europe. It's going to be a huge trouble in terms of the economic stability, political stability on the continent. So we were thinking, and we had a story actually about this by the Kyiv Independent shortly, like 9 days before the invasion, saying that the West will react. We were not sure about the you know, the scale of this reaction, but you know, the West, we were saying it out loud that the West is interested in stepping in and helping Ukraine. We were partly right, but it appeared that, you know, the sense of fear was also strong. The lack of resolve and leadership was also extremely strong. This, moreover, these things were systemic in the Western leadership. It is a product of these decades of universal peace, in general terms, that reigned in the continent. And it produced the kind of leaders that were managers, government managers, rather than, you know, historical figures and, you know, hard decision makers. But it appeared that it's a hard thing to break through, but it's something to work with. Because, you know, back in the days of the Battle of Kyiv, we had basically end loss. And yes, that was a huge boost to the morale, because for the general audience and also for media, because you should have seen, you know, crowds of reporters, of journalists, media reporters, cameras, TVs, everyone meeting up aircraft with javelins, with end loss in the frosty nights at Kyiv airfields. You should have seen this. That was a lot of attention to this. Same goes to javelins, end loss, stingers from Baltic countries. So that was a huge boost to the morales, just showing that, yeah, we on our own, but we still have our friends. We still, not everyone is ready to kneel down to Putin next to us. So that was really working well for this. But in the end, like I said, this systemic and, you know, chronic fear of escalation, of hard decision making too, of historical decisions, It's a thing, but it's something that can be amended. Because just think about this: over the last 2 years, we were beating our heads against the wall, but still, we and, you know, political leaders here in Ukraine, journalists in Ukraine and beyond, public figures, we persuaded the West into providing us with tanks, radars, air defense, missiles, armored vehicles, you name it. It's every single type of weapon provided and sent to Ukraine in large numbers was absolutely unthinkable, beyond any consideration 2 years ago. I'm not even talking about, for instance, the role of Germany in this war, which absolutely switched its position from being one of the biggest Russian apologists and Putin apologists in Europe to being one of the strongest Ukrainian backers. And we are really, really thankful. Sometimes, you know, from the distance of today, from the distance of time right now. We still kind of not really appreciating and not really able to evaluate all the historical things that happening right now. You know, we will have to take a lot of time when this war is over to even, you know, comprehend all these things that happen, because in many ways we are under evaluate and underestimate what's happening.
Let me ask you a biographical question. I note in your bio that you were a fellow with USA Today, and that you covered the Pentagon as you know, part of your time here. Did that give you greater confidence about, you know, Western assistance and about the U.S. actually doing the right thing, even if it was going to be in keeping with Churchill's dictum that the United States does the right thing after systematically eliminating every other option?
There's a tragically funny story because, yes, I was selected via Alfred Friendly program to be a guest reporter at the Pentagon with the USA Today. And it happened in early 2020, which is a funny time, the coming of COVID-19. And I actually came to the United States. I had to spend the first 2 weeks at the Missouri School of Journalism, the heaven of this program. But then the COVID came, and I came to the United States, I think, one of the last flights from Europe to America, because Donald Trump closed the airspace because of the virus. And because of the all those things that were happening because of the pandemic, of course, the program failed. The program was aborted. And instead of spending 6 months working as a journalist at the Pentagon, I had to catch the last possible flight, diplomatic flight, arranged by Ukrainian embassy, and to get back home within the next 2 weeks. So nonetheless, I'm telling you the story because I did my best to spend my best time in America these 2 weeks in the United States. I did my best to bring something from me, from, you know, what America is. So when a lot of people were sitting at home and basically having nothing to do, my colleagues, we had like a bunch of our colleagues, several journalists from around the world. So we did not have a chance to, you know, do something, you know, work anyway. We had to stay at home and wait for some clarity about our situation if we kind of go to our places of deployment, something like that. I was having my best time. It was good. I got a bicycle in the United States, and I was seeing America in the state of Missouri, you know, the people. Back then, there was not such a strict quarantine about this, and there was a lot of activities outside. So I did my time in here. So I was enjoying myself. I was, you know, seeing America from inside, and one of the Americas that exist from inside. And I know a bit about the American history since I was a student. And in general, you know, seeing the American way of life, seeing what America is from inside, and seeing what America is also from outside, it really gave me a lot of confidence about Americans staying with us for as long as possible, or eventually, in the end, doing the right thing, as we just mentioned. Because the things that are being discussed, were being discussed with this defense bill, in general, the fact that, you know, the Ukrainian war and the Ukrainian struggle touched upon so many hearts in America, particularly in America, it's so so obvious, because these values are so close, are so American. It's so much about America, you know, the foundation of this mentality that I saw in America, the very, you know, the foundation of their society. So it's so natural to America to believe in these things. It's not, of course, 100%, but still it's very it's very symptomatic for Americans to feel sympathy towards Ukrainians and the Ukrainian struggle. Another question is that we don't always have a chance to reach out to all Americans and to break through a lot of lies about Ukrainians in the eyes of many Americans. But still, one of the reasons why we're still having attention more than 2 years of war, we still have a lot of attention, we still have a lot of support from many people in our day and time when, you know, stories go away within minutes. Is the Ukrainian war, the Ukrainian in general situation is so simple, so black and white, and so humane that it's really hard to forget. It's pretty surprising that so many people still support and still, you know, pay attention about this in our time. But still it is, because it's simply very humane, I would say. So, yeah. And I think in the end, what we saw at the U.S. Congress and will anti-defense bill fraction just giving up and doing essentially what is right, simply because it's about simple American interests, national security interests, and everybody really understand this. Even the most vocal opposers. And it's very American thing.
You know, I think this is probably a subject for a later podcast, Eric, but the Odyssey of Speaker Johnson, I think will be worth talking about. And I, you know, the only thing I would add to that is I think it's the intersection of American interests, but also American values. And I, you know, I certainly hope, Ilya, that you get a longer look at us sometime. We're coming to the end of our time, unfortunately. I two things. One is I wanted to say, an old colleague of mine, Don Oberdorfer, once said that journalism is the first draft of history. And that's really what you're giving us here. And I think your point about it'll take some time from and some perspective of distance to really truly judge this is absolutely right. But you've provided us a wonderful first draft. The last question I wanted to ask you was just, how do you assess where the war is now?
Ooh, of course, we have come really far. You know, farther than we could even think about 2 years ago, that we'll be still where we are right now. We are facing a very complicated and very hard period of this war. You know, it's a seesaw, really, a seesaw of ups and downs for us in this war. You know, it's the situation of switching from the triumph of getting back to Kherson to the insane massacre and gore at Bakhmut. You know, so it's a seesaw on the ups and downs. We are entering a dark phase of the war, obviously, because of many reasons, external and internal. It's going to be hard and dark. It was never easy, but it would be particularly hard and dark because of the delays in assistance. And I don't think that I should remind anyone about the fact that we have, you know, Ukraine is facing one of the largest war machines in human history. In this, so, and particularly the one that has a very large, almost bottomless Soviet legacy in this, about weapons, about bombs, about many things, and so it always particularly angering that many people perceive Ukraine as the nation of beggars who can't fight the wars on their own. Well, it's Russia. Russia is bigger than life. And especially when it comes to Russia, that is so hardwired about the, you know, crushing this war, about crushing Ukrainian and the kind of Russia that is so hardwired about spending every single bit of resources to get what it wants. So, yeah, because of the delays, a lot of bad things are happening, you know, Ukrainian military slowly and steadily creep back, losing towns one after one. But I must say that given all the critical lack of munitions, and also manpower, I would say that what we have right now, particularly in Donbas, in the Ukrainian East, is a man-made miracle, because given all the lack of basically everything, you know, we are lucky that we are where we are right now. The situation is not worse in this regard, especially when it comes to battlefield situation in there. Because of the motivation, because of the enthusiasm of Ukraine, because of insane heroism demonstrated by Ukrainian soldiers, and also because of a lot of solutions that have helped somehow mitigate the lack of artillery, for instance. We're talking about FPV drones. A lot of innovation, a lot of non-standard thinking, new solutions that are essentially writing a new page in military history, in history of modern warfare, but mostly about absolutely unbelievable will and heroism, despite heavy casualties, despite lack of hope for the next day, but still they're doing this. And I would say that in general, this sentiment, especially when it comes to the Ukrainian military, of that could be described as no matter what happens, no matter what we have, we will be doing what is right. So in many ways, in this sentiment and this principle saved this country, especially when it comes to the Ukrainian military. Now that we have defense bill, it's my feeling and my estimate that in general, the American assistance constitutes close to, I would say, 70-75% of the Ukrainian defense effort, because it's responsible for the most important things, critically important things like air defense, which is especially precious, especially strategically important, but also maintenance of armored vehicles, especially, you know, M2 Bradleys. They are super important and super effective, ended up being super effective. And also, obviously, artillery munitions too, which is also absolutely vital, because after all, it's still an artillery war. Without artillery, no amount of FPV drones can supplement this. Obviously, we have this, this new package, but still, it will take some time for it to start improve the situation. We'll still having a pretty dark period of this. So I think Russians will be doing their best to make use of this gap, especially when it comes to air defense. You know, they are having a very painful attacks on energy infrastructure here in Ukraine. So despite this being a pretty warm springtime, really warm springtime, and also upcoming summertime, we are back into thinking and talking about blackouts and possibility of a general blackout. Thanks God it's not winter, but you know, we happened to run out of air defense, generally run out of defense, not in winter time, but close to summertime. So it's a dark thing. Also, another hard moment is demobilization in Ukraine, which in a general deadlock because of a lot of mistakes made by the Ukrainian authorities and the Ukrainian military, you know, this forceful mobilization, lots of mistakes from our side, but also, you know, the objective reasons, is lots of objective reasons behind these failures, is that, you know, after all, it's 2024, you know, we were supposed to fly on cars, we were supposed to go as tourists to the moon by this time, you know, and instead of that, we have a like World War II, World War I style mobilization, mass mobilization, and forceful mobilization in here. And in our modern society, the world of Netflix, you know, food delivery apps, AI, this is not the way Ukrainian society and any modern society works anymore. So not the way economy works, not the way, you know, employment works. So it's, you know, in our day and time, it's really almost unbelievably hard to launch a general mobilization, especially when it comes to vibrant and very mobile countries and communities and nations like Ukraine. Russia is a pretty different thing in this regard, but, you know, it's extremely hard. So we are in the dark period of this history, of this war, but we have hope. We have hope, and we have all the reasons to have hope. We know the way. We see the way. And like I said, we wasted a lot of time. We wasted a lot of resources. We made a lot of mistakes. But like I said in the beginning, this from the Western side, this reluctance to be indirectly involved, this drive towards not making decisions, is something to be worked with. So we will be working in terms of increasing European output, mobilizing European defense production, because we have a situation in which Russia has reached the peak of its defense production and its war effort. Meanwhile, Europe basically haven't started anything yet because of many reasons, and we will be working with this. I would say that by this time, this U.S. defense bill bought us probably a year, one more year, so that we could, you know, work hard and increase our, you know, potential with the help of Europe and also with the internal production, because a lot of things have been done here in Ukraine too to produce at least something.
At least we're running out of time, I'm afraid, but Ilya, you've been a terrific guest. Thank you very much for joining us. Our guest has been Ilya Ponomarenko, the journalist formerly of the Kyiv Independent. You can follow him on Twitter, and you can support his journalism at Buy Me a Coffee. He's the author of I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. And thank you very much for joining us on Shield of the Republic today.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a very interesting conversation.
Thank you, Ilya.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.